seeing. I have to wait. Okay. Today is May 21st, and we're going to continue on this take. We said yesterday we'd talk about the Nevada Board of Medical Examiners.
Okay.
And your involvement with that, you started that in 1977.
1977, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I won't repeat a lot of those stories. I think we can excerpt them later from that board's thing, because it's my history. But essentially, it was the spring of 77 when the legislature had just passed the conversion, when I was sitting in George's office, and we had just been celebrating the fact that the legislature approved it, when Michael Callahan called, and that story I'll just repeat briefly. He called, and I was sitting in George's office, and we were talking about the next stage in the conversion. Mike said to George, he called him the dean, and he called me Scully. He used to call people by their last name, or he'd call you Doc or something like mm-hmm. that. So anyway, he's talking to George and says, you know, now we're going to have this medical school. We ought to have somebody from the medical school on the Board of Medical Examiners, because you'll be licensing, or we'll be licensing, future graduates. And George said, well, I'm too busy, Mike. And I think he did call him Mike. I'm too busy. Now, maybe George had in the back of his mind that he was going to be leaving, because he resigned a few months later. But what he told the governor was, I'm too busy. I don't have time to do it. But why don't you consider Tom Scully? He's sitting here, he knows other people on the board. So he said, well, put him on. So he put him on, and he said, I think he said to me, Scully, I want you to serve on the Board of Medical Examiners. I said, yeah, you don't. You didn't argue with Michael Callahan, really. And he said, well, I'll talk to Ken McLean, and he'll get back to you. So a day or two later, Ken McLean, who was the secretary of the board at the time, had been for years, called me and said, this is what the job entails and the duties. And it was considerably less than it became 20 years later. It was I think we met four times a year for a day or two, and we were licensing maybe, 40 doctors a year, and they were doing very little disciplinary work. They might have had one or two disciplinary hearings a year. Anyway, I said yes to the governor and said yes to Ken McLean. I got my appointment, signed all the oaths of office, and took my seat just about when I got back from the trip to Spain with Celia and her mother and the aunts that I told earlier. So it was sometime in August of 77 I went to the first meeting, maybe September. Simultaneous, almost, George resigning as the dean and my being appointed as dean. So all of a sudden, I'm appointed as the dean of the medical school, and I'm appointed to the Board of Medical Examiners. So
what
I'm
capacity? Just on the board?
Just, yeah, there were only, at that time, there were five physicians, and the legislature had just passed part of a bill that required public members on various disciplinary or various regulatory boards. So for the first time ever, there were two board members. One was Harvey Kay, who used to run used car and automobile parts, and had been a big contributor to UNR football, and that's how he knew Mike O'Callaghan. So Mike appointed him, and he came to the first meeting, and he said to Ken McLean, and Ted Jacobs was on the board at that time, and some others, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? And Ken said, well, we don't know either. We'll figure it out as we go along. What are public members supposed to do? And Ken McLean, he was not happy with the law, because he said, well, why the hell do we have these public members? They don't know nothing about medicine or doctors, and why, you know. Well, it turned out ultimately that the public members really turned out to be very positive over time. But it took a while for them to sort out their role.
And you don't want to air your dirty linen.
Oh, no. And it was very cautious for a while. And the other one was Edwina Pryor. No, that's not true. She became later. The first one was Ida Crockett, who was a Democratic supporter, a black woman from Las Vegas. And she was the first public member. Later came Edwina Pryor, because she was appointed by Bob List when he was the governor, and she's a Republican, big shot in the Republican politics. Anyway, I show up, a new member of the board, and I was taking, I think, I think it was Les Morin from Elko. I think he retired or resigned or wasn't going to serve any longer. I think that was the place, but I'm not sure of that. Anyway, there's five physicians. I'm the new physician on the block, along with Ken McLean, Ted Jacobs, Dick Grundy, and forgotten who the fourth physician was. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, and Ida Crockett and Harvey Kay. So that's the new board. And of course, I started as the dean. So simultaneously, I took on the dean's role, and we talked about that. I won't repeat it, the conversion of the school. But the first year or two, there wasn't very much activity on the Board of Medical Examiners. Frankly, I could look up the statistics, but maybe 40 or 50 licensees. We'd all sit around the table. It was so inefficient. We'd all sit around the table on a Saturday, usually four times a year. We'd meet a couple of times in Vegas and a couple of times in Reno, and we'd literally interview doctors who came for a license. And it was very...
Was the examining process as well?
But it was pretty informal. It was an oral exam.
Oh,
and
no written?
They had already done that. In order to meet the board, it was a personal interview. We wanted to eyeball them, and we also wanted to talk to them. And we always felt you can't support this in terms of you can't support this in terms of examining. But we thought that by talking to the doctors and eyeballing them and listening to them, we could pick up sort of subtle issues that they may not be competent or they might be impaired. And in fact, there were a couple of physicians who came before the board, and when we started grilling them around the table, it turned out that some of them really did have things they were hiding. They were coming to Nevada from other states. They thought they'd get a license here. I can remember a couple who had been in prison but didn't tell anybody. We had a couple who broke down in tears. They were going through a divorce and they were depressed. We had a couple who actually showed up with alcohol on their breath. So there were a few times when the personal interview led to the board saying, look, doctor, you're not ready to practice medicine and we're not going to give you a license, which was our prerogative. You go home to wherever you came from, you know, straighten out your emotional life or deal with your alcohol or whatever. That was the level at which the board would meet with physicians. It subsequently changed over time. But we all felt that it was a worthwhile thing. Anyway, we would meet four times a year. And
where were the offices?
The offices at that time were on Terminal Way, but in a building down the street close to the airport that subsequently had a big fire and burned down. Mm-hmm. Then later, I don't know, probably about 1983, we moved down the other end of Terminal Way. I don't know the exact addresses. We stayed on the same street, but we moved from one end down near the airport to the other end down near Mill Street. And it had been for years, you know, just run out of the Baker Lane office of the State Medical Association.
That's what I thought.
And the secretary was the same secretary. Nelson Neff worked with the board, and I'll think of the lady who was there for a while. But then eventually they got their own staff. It was supported, as you know, by doctors' license fees. And I think at the time I entered the board, we had one executive director and one secretary. That's all there were, two people, plus the five physicians who then had the two public members added to it, I think that year, 1977. I'm quite sure it was 1977. And that was it.
I guess the names of these people would be in the...
It's all in the book. Okay. Got the whole thing, and as a matter of fact, it's in the appendix.
All right.
We can dig it all out. Then, and Bryce Rhodes was the attorney. Then, about a year or two into it, the board began to become more active. I've always credited that personally to Ted Jacobs, and then Tony Carter, my former partner in Las Vegas. I worked for him down there. He eventually was appointed by Mike O'Callaghan, and there was sort of a change in the board. There was younger people coming on, new thoughts, new ideas, And I think that the three or four younger people, including myself, felt that if the board was going to be at all creditable, we had to not only license physicians, but we had to establish a better way to do it. And also we had to take more seriously the disciplining of physicians, investigations. We had no investigator, so we hired our first investigator. It was pretty hit or miss. At that time, the complaints, if they did come in, would come in to Ken McLean, and as secretary, he had the full authority to decide whether the board ever heard about it or whether it was ever taken any further. And frankly, we all felt that it needed to be streamlined. And that also was, as I suggested earlier, last time we talked about what was going on in ethics, there was also in medicine generally and in the public, probably had a lot to do with consumer advocacy groups, probably had a lot to do with this guy in Washington who's been, the last 10 or 15 years talking about consumer advocacy things. There was a lot of
Ralph Nader.
There was a lot of criticism of medicine. We were protecting our own. We were not cleaning ranks. We were not disciplining the way we should have. The public was losing trust.
Did you feel that had a little?
I think.
Truth to it.
Oh yes, there's no question it had truth to it.
You weren't protecting your
own. I think there was, and I don't deny that. Mm-hmm. I think that there was a hesitancy to, first of all, acknowledge that physicians were impaired from alcohol or drugs.
And ruin a person's whole life.
Right. There was a hesitancy to make anything public. There was no public law. It was all done behind closed doors. Well, not only does our legislature and others around the country say there's going to be an open meeting law, and public complaints against physicians or any professional, including the bar, must be public, that the public has a right to know, that physicians who have problems with drugs and alcohol have to be disciplined. So that was going on nationally. Other boards in other states were changing their laws. Hospitals were getting sued. Boards of trustees of hospitals were getting sued for failure to discipline, failure to limit privileges, failure to correct physicians who they knew or had reason to know. So a lot of it was that. Then the last part that I can think of immediately was the whole thrust of malpractice suits. Malpractice suits were skyrocketing nationwide in the 70s and early 80s. Yes, we got into a more litigious society, but there were more and more attorneys taking on malpractice suits. There was a lot of public discussion. So patients and their families and others were saying, well, wait a minute, I'm going to sue that guy. Or that usually was guy, but woman too, mostly physicians who either were guilty of malpractice or allegedly, or were impaired by drugs or alcohol, or whatever. And so the public was becoming more aware of the inadequacies of our profession. And then there were studies being published about the amount of drugs and alcohol. So all of this is going on in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was on the board. And we also felt we have to do something about this. It's time that we have to become more active as other boards. And I went to a couple of national meetings in 78, 79, 80, and several members of our board did. And we were hearing what was going on nationally. You better go back home, the message was, and get your board in order. You better look at your law. You better be more proactive in disciplining. You can't ignore malpractice judgments against physicians. You have to be more thorough in investigating their background. You can't let physicians go from one state to the other to escape prosecution or in one place. And there was a lot of that went on. So to answer your question, I think there was professionally a fair amount of looking the other way. There certainly were examples in our state and in other states where physicians who just surrendered their license and said, I'm going to leave, were just allowed to leave because it was a lot easier than, and hospitals did the same, you can resign from our staff, get out of town, leave, and we won't bother you.
That's what we wanted.
Yes,
we
sure.
We worked for that.
We don't want, exactly.
It's easier.
It's easier, you don't have to fight about it. Mm-hmm. So all of that is going on at the same time that some of our own legislators and the governor is asking what's going on, and new members of the board saying, hey, I don't want to be a party to a sham. I don't want to be a party to a mediocre operation. If we're going to be serious about this, we have to tighten up our investigation of physicians coming into the state, which we did, and we also have to take seriously complaints from the public and investigate them more thoroughly, and have disciplinary hearings, which then by, I think, 79 had to be public. Maybe it was the legislature of 81, but I think it was 79, had to be public. And so all of a sudden, what had been, and the statistics are in that, book over there, there were very little disciplinary action by the Board of Medical Examiners, one or two a year for years. And then, of course, in the last 15 years, it began to go up and
it's not a popular job.
No, sure. It's not. You don't make any friends. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I personally, I think, made some more enemies, and combined with my now being the dean of the school, with all of the objections to the school, the two things together. But the members of the board stuck together and were good, and we said, look, if you're going to do this job, you just got to take the bitter with the batter.
Dr. McLean
was the secretary. Secretary Treasurer had the administrative responsibility. He was paid a small salary to run the board, if you will. The president was sort of the person who convened the meetings four or five times a year, and the president presided over the hearings, and there were very few at that time. What happened then over the next couple of years was a board that became more active. Ted Jacobs was elected president, and he then served in that capacity for almost 20 years because he kept getting reelected. He was really a wonderful president. He convened good meetings. He conducted very good hearings, and he was very fair. Ted is an internist. He's he was with me in Spain. Yeah, he and Parvin Jacobs, but he and well thought of in Las Vegas. So he served for 20 years, and I guess I served for 16. In 1982, I went on my sabbatical to New York. But I flew back three or four times that year to participate in the board meetings. At that time, Ken McLean announced his resignation and retirement. He'd been on the board 30-some years and told the governor he did not want to be reappointed. And so that spring, now the spring of 1983, Ted is re-elected president, and I'm elected secretary-treasurer. I'm no longer the dean of the school. This is 1983. I'm no longer dean, so I have more time. And they paid me a small salary, and now it's my job to run the board or to administer the board. And I realized right away that we were going to get busier. The population was going up.
Big growth in doctors.
The number of doctors was expanding, and the number of complaints was expanding for all the other reasons I just said. The public is now, and the public is demanding, do something about these doctors. Now, I'm not trying to make it sound like it was a terrible thing, but there were doctors who needed to be disciplined. So I accepted that job. No longer was I the dean, so I had a little more time. I was back working at the Special Children's Clinic. I had returned from my sabbatical, and I was working on these ethical issues and developing an ethics curriculum. And within a couple of months, I remember talking to Ted and the board. I said to them, this is not the way to do it. One person should not be the gatekeeper for all of this. It's too much responsibility. Too much responsibility for one person. I'm not Ken McLean. I can't do it. I don't have his I didn't have his reputation in the community. But secondly, I think it puts too much authority and power in the hands of one person. And I think it puts too much stress on the person as well. And I said, we have to change the way we do this operation. In the meantime, I said, we've got to get in some administrative help, and we've got to get investigators and secretaries. So the board was doing pretty well financially, so at that time, we hired a new executive director. The former executive director retired, and Bryce Rhodes said he was going to retire. So we then had a new secretary treasurer. We had to find a new executive director. We had to hire some secretaries and investigators, and we had to find a new attorney. So I was down at the County Courthouse. I was back working in Special Children's, and I didn't mention yesterday when we were talking about that, I get very involved in the evaluation of child abuse and sexual abuse of children, which the rest of the pediatric community was sort of glad to have me do, because they. And people in private practice really don't want to get involved with child abuse. They certainly don't want to get, well, I shouldn't say all, but many don't want to get involved with the DA or the cops or the Child Protective Service. And the fact that I was a salaried employee of the medical school working at Special Children's Clinic, I think made a lot of them happy, and they would actually refer children to me. Do you think this kid has been abused? So I developed sort of a little sub-specialty of child abuse, both physical and sexual. Well, anyway, I'm down at the courthouse one day testifying on a child abuse case. It might have been a grand jury. And I meet Larry Leslie in the hallway. And Larry had been the counsel for the Board of Regents when the school started and when we converted the school, and I got to know him there. He subsequently left the Board of Regents and went back into private law practice. And I said to him, Larry, Bryce Rhodes is leaving the Board of Medical Examiners. Ken is retired. How do I go about getting an attorney? Do I advertise or whatever? How do I get an attorney to come and work for the board? So he was cute, and I think he's told this story. He said, well, here's a card, and if you wait about 15 minutes and call this phone number, I'll give you an answer. So he handed me his business card, and when I got back to the office, I called, and I said, Larry, this is the number on the card. He said, I'd be happy to meet with the board, and I've got time in private practice. If you'd like, I'll be glad to, so the rest is history, as they say. Larry then came and took Bryce's job part-time in private practice. We actually contracted with him for a number of years. And then eventually, a few years ago, he left his private practice, came to work for the board full-time, first as the board's attorney, and then later we got another attorney, and Larry took over the job as executive director, which he's doing now. At any rate, he's now executive director.
I see.
Yeah, he's now executive director, but he had been our counsel, mm-hmm. first in private practice and later as a full-time employee. But the story I wanted to tell was he came over and I started working with him, and it was clear, as I said earlier, that I didn't feel the way this was done was right, that one person would review these complaints. And as the complaints came in more and more, it became a very tough job. I would spend hours down there reading these complaints. And we only had one investigator who wasn't terribly good. We ultimately replaced him, and now the board, I think, has three. And so we decided that what we would do is the following summer, in anticipation of the 1985 legislature, our legislatures are always on odd years, mm-hmm. we would have workshops with the board. We would get consultants in from around the country, which we did. We'd invite people from other boards that were more sophisticated, including Oregon and Washington, to meet with us. And over the course of a number of sessions, both in Las Vegas and in Reno, and I think we went up at the lake a couple of times, we essentially rewrote the entire Medical Practice Act, which took the authority out of the Secretary Treasurer and put it into an investigative committee of three. We also propose that the board be expanded to 9 people, 6 physicians and 3 public members, which it presently is. That, yes, it would be a public process, but we would be permitted by law to have this investigative committee of 3 review all complaints in private, and only when a formal complaint was filed against the physician would it become public, because we were, as you suggested earlier, sensitive that we didn't ruin a physician's livelihood or reputation by being falsely accused. And the number of complaints were going up and up and up. I've got the figure someplace, but last year I think they reviewed 600 complaints, but in 1985 we were probably reviewing 200 to 300 complaints a year.
Wow.
Now, a lot of them were frivolous, and a lot of them were anger, and it's no question that many people complained about physicians because the communication between the patient, family, and physician was so bad, the assumption was he must be trying to hide something or she must be trying to hide something. And I've given many a talk to physicians about the more open you are with your patients, the less likely you are to get sued or to have a complaint filed against you. Well, so we began a new process. We took that to the legislature in 1985, and I was the one that presented it as the secretary treasurer. And again, I was an employed physician at the school, and I had time to get down to the legislature. Everybody else on the board is working, you know, they're all doctors in practice. So Larry Leslie and I went down to a number of hearings, made our case. The legislature, after some argument and some objection from some of the medical groups on some specific areas, essentially adopted the rewrite of the law that the board had put together with these consultants, essentially adopted the whole thing. And what now is the Medical Practice Act, which was passed in 1985 and under which the board now operates, has essentially been what they've been doing for the last 12 or 13 years. Six physicians, 3 public members, an investigative committee of 3 that investigates all complaints against physicians. Also investigates complaints against drug and alcohol, and we got in the law the ability from the legislature to send physicians to treatment for anything, but mostly drug and alcohol, and not to do that in private if they agreed voluntarily to first have acknowledged their addiction, but then go get help. They wouldn't have a complaint file against them. But as you know, there were several who refused, and ultimately they had complaints filed against them because they refused to seek help. So that was a change. Established a much more formal exam procedure and went out and got physicians from all over the state to help us examine, because we were now licensing up to 180 to 200 doctors a year from what used to be like 40 a year. Mm-hmm. And that had nothing to do with the board. That was simply the growth in Nevada, more in the south than in the north, as you know. So all of the statistics, you know, are just a straight line up, a rapid increase. And so we got very involved in some very difficult and public disciplinary actions. And so anyway, 1985, just to complete the chronology, and then we can talk about some other things. In 1985, I had been serving now for 8 years, went from 77 to 85. I then told the governor and Ted that I did not want another appointment, although I would have been reappointed. I just resigned and said, no, I don't want any more, because Celia and I had returned from our sabbatical. I had just gotten a contract from Simon & Schuster for Playing God, and I realized that Celia and I had to have a lot of time to write that book. I didn't know then that I would be getting a kidney transplant in 87. So I said, fine, I've had my 8 years, that's enough. And we also put in the 85 law, which I think is the right thing to do, and I supported, that in the future physicians would be limited to 2 4-year terms. No physician could serve more than 8 years in a row. If there was a hiatus of 4 more years, they could, or 3 years, they could be reappointed. But we wanted to get rid of of the old system where a few doctors were on the board and stayed on there almost in perpetuity, 30 and 40 years, well, 35 years. And we didn't think that was right. We felt that it was a corporate responsibility of every physician to participate in the licensing and the disciplining of their colleagues. This was not a small little group of people working on behalf of the state. This was the whole profession's responsibility. So we engaged several hundred doctors. I went and talked to lots of them, who said I'd be happy to participate not only in the licensing and examining of physicians, but I'd be happy to participate in the discipline. So we set up another system, which was when we received a complaint against the physician, we would go to fellow physicians, consultants, just the way they do in hospital staffs, at the opposite end of the state. So our investigators would go to the office of the physician in question or the hospital in question, get as much of the records as we could. Then that investigator would interview people, get statements, and then all of that would go to several physicians in the same specialty, practicing the same level of medicine, presumably, but at the opposite end of the state, on the basis that they weren't in direct competition. They probably didn't know one another, although some probably did. If they knew one another, they were to exclude themselves or recuse themselves, as the word goes. But essentially, they would be looking at a colleague at the opposite end of the state and be able to give the board an independent judgment about whether the accusations and what this physician has been accused of made any sense. And so we then started, if you will, a peer review process, which we felt it ought to be, within the state. And so when physicians in Vegas we got a complaint against a physician in Vegas, people in Reno would review it and vice versa, or people in the rural communities. And out of that then would come the legal process that if there was reason to file a complaint, the investigative committee would file it. We also set up a system very much like a grand jury jury. That is, the investigative committee of three would be privy to all of the private investigation. And once they filed the complaint formally, they were out of it. The other six members would then be the hearing body. They would sit and listen to the evidence. And we, I think, to our credit and to the board's credit and to Larry Leslie and others, we've kept those two groups separate for, 10, 11 years, and it's worked. That is, when you're assigned for, and the president would make the assignments, when you're assigned to the investigative committee for usually a period of 1 or 2 years, you didn't sit on any of the adjudicating hearings, and you were bound in conscience not to discuss those cases that you reviewed with the other members of the board and vice versa. So rather than the same group of people prior to 1985 sort of sitting as judge and jury, which everyone criticized, including myself, we set up a system that sort of mimicked the grand jury jury system, which we felt was a lot fairer. Well, anyway, I resigned in 85, got off the board. Celia and I wrote the book, as we said the other day. I went through my second parathyroid surgery, and then in 87 I had my kidney transplant. Well, I'm feeling very good now in 88. 3 years has gone by. I've had nothing to do with the board at all, although I think from time to time they'd ask me to review, like any other physician as a consultant, review a complaint. In 88, I told Ted that I was feeling well. I'd been a year or so from my transplant. The book was published. The book was actually on the market. It had been released. That I would be happy to serve on the board again because I did enjoy that work and thought it was a valuable thing to do. And I talked to Governor Bryan. I saw him at some sort of a meeting and told him that I would be happy to take an appointment if he wanted to reappoint me. And he'd asked me a couple of times whether I would ever want to go back on the board. So I said yes, and he reappointed me. So I got reappointed in 1988 after a hiatus of 3 years, and was reappointed by Bob Miller and served out the next 8 years from 88 to 96, and I finished in 96. And the new law, of course, for both Ted and I, prohibited any of us from, after 1985, from serving for more than 8 years, which I think is a very good part of the law. So now Ted is retired, I'm retired, Nafis Nagy, who'd been on the board, is retired. Many of the public members during the 70s and 80s are all finished. So the board now is new people, all good, young physicians from both Reno and Vegas and Carson City, and new public members. And they're now...
And it's the same structure.
Same structure. So. Yeah, we have an executive director. There's 9 employees. They have a full-time attorney.
It's the main office is here.
It's the main office in Reno and a branch office in Las Vegas.
Oh, there was a branch office.
Yeah, they closed it after a while because it was found to be not needed. It was too expensive. But now it's all run out of Reno, but it's an executive director with an assistant. Three individuals who do all of the checks of credentials for people coming into the state, and 3 investigators who do all the investigation of the complaints. So it's a 3-and-3 system. And then a receptionist and a full-time attorney. And of course, Larry Leslie's an attorney, but he doesn't practice law in this context. So now I think they've got 9 or 10 people. They're now up to...
The most recent, just for purposes of ending the story,
the most recent statistics in 1997, just to give you an idea, in 87 there were 1,400 doctors in Nevada. There are now 2,800, double in 10 years. In 1985 was when the disciplinaries began, but here, and you can take this with you, in 1980, I went on the board in 77, I can go back and look those figures up. In 1980, the population in Nevada was 800,000. There was 1,100 doctors in the state, and we licensed 200 people that year. That was 144 physicians per 100,000. 18 years later, in 1997, there's 2,800 doctors in the state, almost triple. The board licensed 440 new doctors. The population was 1.7 million, and the ratio was 160 physicians per 100,000. So the number of doctors in those 18 years almost tripled.
Most of them going to Clark County.
Oh, yeah, most of them, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And yet the board is still here.
I mean, the board can meet anyway because they meet.
Travel all over.
Oh, we travel. Yeah, our investigators are on the road all the time. The board meets every other time. They meet now 6 times a year, 3 times in Vegas, 3 times in Reno. So where the administrative offices are really doesn't make an awful lot of difference.
No, and in this age of computers, makes less difference than it ever did.
Oh, it's all computerized. Yeah. They're faxed back and forth,
sure.
You know. But I'll give you this just to put in your stuff. It shows you. But anyway, so much of what is here, I participated in. There's stuff that goes back to 77. And this little dotted line across here is why we put that in to show where the new law went in.
Oh.
And that's all that means. But anyway, those are some of the statistics. So that's my history of the board. I served as... Oh, so when I came back in 88... Ron Avery was the secretary treasurer, and then I think in 91 he got off the board, and Del Snyder was there for a year or two, and I think I was re-elected because I again had time. And the other guys were all in practice. I was re-elected the secretary in 1991, and I remained that to I think 95, and then the last year on the board, Ted was finished. And they elected me president. So I was the president the last year on the board.
You could, after a hiatus, as I understand the law, after a 3-year period, can
I think
you
it's
go back
two.
On?
I think it's two.
You could go back on?
I could. I wouldn't. But, I mean, anybody could. Ted Jacobs could. Anyone. I think I'd have to check that out specifically, and I will when we edit this. I think it's if you've been off for more than 2 years, you could be reappointed for another 4 years, but... After 8 years, 2 4-year terms in succession, you have to get off. That was not the case prior to 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, there were Ken McLean and Les Moore and a few others who, you look in that book, served 25 and 30 years.
Yeah, they were it.
Yeah, they were the board. But there was also, you know...
And they knew everybody.
And few physicians, and most of them were in the North. And so I think what we saw was an evolution of an institution that was growing with the state, and it had to change. Change not only because of what was going on in medicine locally, but what was going on in medicine nationally. And now, interestingly enough, Nevada's law has been duplicated or replicated by a number of other states because it's been, it was well thought out. The other thing we did, which really upset a lot of people and still does some, we got the legislature to agree that no longer was it safe for anyone to go into practice of medicine with a license after 1 year internship. That was passé. I mean, that was nonsense. Every specialty in the country and every medical school and the AMA and everybody said, you know, including family medicine, which is the most recent specialty, and that 3 years was really the minimum. And so we were the first state, the very first state, to require, or the legislature put in the law, to require that you must have 3 years of graduate training after medical school before you'd even be eligible for a licensure. No more 1 year internship. Now, for those who were already practicing in Nevada, there was a grandfather clause, and there was, I think, 2 years in which anyone with 2 or 1 year could, obviously, once you had a license, you could keep it. And there was no attempt to get rid of older doctors, there was no attempt to get rid of physicians who didn't have the 3 years. But from 1980, roughly 85 or 86 on, you had to have 3 years. And there have been a number of physicians who have appealed to the board. There have been a number of politicians and friends of politicians who had friends from back east or back someplace who had a 1 year internship and wanted to come to Las Vegas to retire or wanted to come to Vegas to make a living and had been practicing in some town and had had a 1 year internship a number of years ago. The answer was simply no. Our hands are tied. The legislature says this is the rule. You get your 3 years. Now, then about 1987, I think, maybe 88, well, the 87 legislature, I'm not sure exactly, there was a pressure on the legislature. Some of the rural communities were saying this three-year law is limiting us from getting doctors. Well, that was hocus. We demonstrated with our statistics that that was not the case. And as a matter of fact, the osteopathic law still allows an osteopath to get a license with a 1 year internship. The medical board, and I might just say parenthetically, you know, all the different health boards are separate. We don't have an umbrella board in Nevada like we do, you know, like many other states do. Medicine is medicine, osteopath is osteopath, chiropractic, Chinese medicine, acupuncture, and of course later homeopathy that we fought, tooth and nail, it's passed. And I told that story earlier, homeopathy and naturopathy and all of those things, the legislature in its wisdom, you know, passed a lot of this stuff in the 80s. To our chagrin, we thought it was nonsense. But anyway, we showed that there was no evidence that the rural communities were being were suffering. We knew what the issue was, and everybody else did. The issue was that you can't isolate a physician in a small community with no support and not a decent salary, and his wife is unhappy or husband unhappy. There's lots of reasons why people don't go to small towns. At any rate, they passed a law that said if someone had a 1 year internship and 5 years of experience in another state, they could get a special license to go to a small town in Nevada, a rural community, and practice, provided the county commissioners petitioned the board for an exemption to the law, because the county commissioners to determine in their county the physician was needed. So it started with a political process. The county commissioners would say, we need this doctor in our underserved area. You can certify the board that he has a 1 year internship and 5 years of experience elsewhere. And we will certify that we need him, and you give him a limited license. The license limited that physician to that county. At the end of 3 years, if that physician kept his part of the bargain, worked in that underserved area and practiced medicine and had no complaints or malpractice suits adjudicated against him, none of that problem, then he could apply to the board for an unrestricted license. So it was sort of an equivalent. 5 years of experience plus 3 years in Nevada would make it 8 years minimum. That we would, the board under the law could assume that was an equivalent. And we've had, I think, two physicians who, after serving in a small community for 3 years, applied for a regular license. And as you might expect, the two of them headed straight to Las Vegas the minute they got their permanent license.
So this worked out all right?
It worked out fine. And as a matter of fact, I think the number of licenses given under that rural exemption through the years amounted to, it's even in here, I think. If not, I can look it up when we edit this. Here it is. Physicians licensed to practice in medically underserved areas of Nevada from 1987, when the law was passed, or the to 1997, those 10 years, restricted license, rural exemption, 30 licenses issued.
So this was an accommodation
to rural legislators, right?
But one that worked out well.
Yeah, it worked out fine, and but it's still, in our view, and many people still argue this, it's still. And of course, while those 30 were given in those 10 years, those 30 were given, the people who met the regular license in law was 1,800 doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So there were 1,800 doctors who came and got regular licenses and ended up all over the state when those 30 were getting the limited license based upon not having 3 years. So I think that
and
also...
of those, the two went on.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
There may be more since. I don't know. That was a year ago that I last. So